Washington voters backed Sanders. Doesn't that mean Washington voters' superdelegates back Sanders? Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Bernie Sanders had a huge win in the Washington state caucuses, more than 70% of the vote. But tell that to the superdelegates. Most of them are still backing Hillary Clinton. A superdelegate can be a party leader or a lawmaker. No one elected them to be superdelegates at the caucus. They just get to go to the Democratic National Convention. And unlike regular delegates, they get to back the candidate of their personal choice. Well, Charlie Best thinks that is undemocratic. He started a petition that calls for Washington superdelegates to fall in line and get behind Sanders.
This petition was about supporting a more democratic party. It was not about candidates. It was more about the process. If an individual wants to support a candidate, I support their right to support a candidate. So, for example, one of the superdelegates is my congressional critter. Well, if my congressional person wants to support a candidate, I believe they ought to go to their local caucus, get elected. They're going to get elected. Everybody knows them. Go to their county convention. They're going to get elected. Everybody knows them. Go to the state, be elected as a delegate, and go through the same process that all other delegates in our state go through. And, you know, they're probably going to end up as delegates anyway. But this thought that there is a class of delegate called a superdelegate just smacks to me of elitism. I believe the rank and file has the voice, and that voice ought to be listened to. And any time that voice is basically not being listened to, it bothers me.
That is petitioner Charlie Best. So let's meet someone who has been a superdelegate. Dwight Pelz is also the former chair of the Washington State Democratic Party. Welcome, Dwight.
Hello.
So this superdelegate system is unelected, elitist, and undemocratic. What do you say to that?
Well, it sounds a little bit like the criticisms of the caucus system.
Mm-hmm.
We have a caucus system here, and it's a very positive method for the Democratic Party in Washington State to pick their preference for presidential nominee. But everybody knows that it disenfranchises about 90% of the Democrats in the state. So Bernie Sanders has done very well with caucus states across the country. I'm sure Bernie Sanders likes caucus states, where the activists get out, and then fundamentally the activists have a much larger voice than the rank-and-file, grassroots Democrat that Charlie's speaking about.
Well, whatever we think of caucuses, let's now talk about the system of superdelegates, unelected and able to back somebody that the voters didn't. What do you think of that?
Okay, and I just want to say I hope Charlie starts a petition to do away with the caucuses because they're not entirely Democratic. So I think it's very positive for us to have a multi-tier system in place where in the states, either in a primary where lots of Democrats vote or in caucuses where not so many Democrats vote, we pick delegates based on those local elections. But then we have members of Congress, the governor, party officials, they weigh in. And in a sense, they are a potential to be a moderating voice in the process. If the National Republican Party had the same system that we have in the Democratic Party this year, neither Ted Cruz nor Donald Trump would be a serious candidate for president right now because none of the superdelegates are supporting either one of those guys. You know, none of the members of Congress that would be superdelegates, none of the governors that would be superdelegates support Cruz or Trump. They're horrified by these two people. They would put a moderating brake on the party, and Cruz and Trump would not be serious names right now.
Now, I know you're not saying that Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump and Ted Cruz are the same, but why are you putting them even in the same unwise category?
Well, I'm saying that if the Republicans had our system, it would be working very well for them. And I'm sure if Charlie Best had a Republican senator who was a superdelegate, he would be telling that person not to vote for Donald Trump or Ted Cruz.
And but why is Bernie Sanders an example of the same thing?
I think it's good to have a backup system. It's like having a House and a Senate. A bill has to go through the House, and then it has to go through the Senate. Our nomination has to go through the primaries and caucuses, and they have to go through the superdelegates.
Well, at least congressmen and senators are elected, unlike superdelegates.
You know, they are elected, and once they're elected, they go and they take votes, and sometimes the people at home don't like the votes, and they can face the voters next time they're up for election. And if the voters don't like the way our superdelegates vote, well, they'll take that into consideration when these people run for office again.
Okay, now let's talk about what superdelegates should do now. Washington State has 17 of them. Most of them are on record supporting Clinton. Nearly 33,000 people have signed a petition calling on them to follow the popular vote and get behind Sanders. What do you think our superdelegates should do now?
Well, I think as they do what elected officials always do. They take a look at the situation, they weigh the pros and cons, and they make a principled decision that they think is the best vote for them to take. And I think if they make a decision that Hillary Clinton is their candidate for president, then they should vote for Hillary Clinton. If they think that Bernie Sanders is their candidate, and they can factor in the outcome of the caucuses, but if they make that decision, they should make that vote. I'm not going to dictate to these people how they should vote on this thing.
Okay, but that's predicated on your premise that the purpose of this representative democracy layer is to mellow out the extremes. And so I'm wondering, what is Bernie Sanders calling for that is so extreme that it's worth contravening the will of Washington voters?
No, I'm not saying that in the Washington side that we are facing, and the Democratic side that we're facing extremes. That's not true. Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton are marvelous elected officials with a long history of public service. You can't say that about Donald Trump or Ted Cruz. These people are nut jobs. And they're dangerous.
Okay, so given your respect for both Sanders and Clinton, are you then telling superdelegates that in this case it ain't Trump? To go ahead and follow the will of the voters and back Sanders.
No, I'm telling them to vote their conscience.
Okay. Final question. You are understandably concerned about preserving democracy, if you said. What does it do to democracy when you tell your voters that their unelected superdelegates are going to overrule your wishes?
Well, we've already said that the caucus attendees are overruling, you know, the vote of the Democratic voters who don't get to vote in a primary. This is not a public election. This is a method by which the party chooses their candidate. We choose to have caucuses in Washington. I think caucuses are great. And we choose to have superdelegates. And that combination of factors is the way that the Democratic Party is going to pick their nomination. It's not a direct democracy. It's not New Hampshire town hall. It's a representative democracy within the Democratic Party.
Dwight Pelz, former superdelegate, former chair of the Washington State Democratic Party. Thank you so much for joining us live.
All righty.
Sanders is going to get most of the delegates, most of Washington's 101 regular delegates, but Hillary Clinton is poised to pick up most of Washington's 17 superdelegates. And you're listening to The Record. By the way, we'd love to hear what you thought of that last conversation and what you think of Washington's system of caucuses and superdelegates. We're tweeting always at KUOW. We're on Facebook, KUOW Public Radio. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning into The Record. Several years ago, a Seattle man named Jonathan Rosenblum hiked into a lake in the North Cascades called Coon Lake.
And I began asking around why it was named that, especially when I found out that there were no raccoons in the area.
Rosenblum concluded the name had racist origins, so he set out to convince state officials to rename it. The name he proposed was Howard Lake, after Wilson Howard, a black prospector who staked claims near the lake in the 1800s. And eventually the state did change the name to Howard Lake. And later, with help from state Senator Pramila Jayapal, the federal government followed suit. Now, Senator Jayapal wants Washington State to review dozens of what she says are ethnically and racially offensive geographic names.
Names signify inclusion or exclusion. They signify history that is either incredibly painful for somebody or incredibly important for other people to understand and remember why something, you know, why something should not be around. And when you have these names that are racist slurs, I think what you end up seeing is people feeling like they don't belong here, people feeling like they don't understand why other people do not see how painful those names are to them. And so they really do matter. And you know, when you have park lands, when you have state lands, national lands that belong to everybody, I think it's really, really important that whatever names we have there reflect the best of who we are as a country and don't continue to move the ideas that were present when those names were put down. I mean, there's some really good research that shows that those names were really put there for a purpose of exclusion at a particular time in the country's history.
Since this began for you with Coon Lake, you've done research. What are some names you found that you want action on?
Well, one is Jim Crow. We have several places in this state that are called Jim Crow. There are 22 locations that are called Squaw. Various Indian tribes have been complaining about those names for a long time. There are others. There's actually one that includes Negro. There's a Chinaman. So there's a variety of them that are clearly tied to racial slurs.
And what do you want done with these names?
So what I wanted to do is have a proactive process. So instead of the process we have now, which is if somebody's upset about a name, they can come forward and suggest a name change. I wanted us as a state to actually go through and proactively look at what are these names that we absolutely have no question about, you know, the fact that they're incredibly offensive and racist. How do we identify those names? And then how does the Department of Natural Resources and the State Board of Geographic Names start a process that goes out and says, we are going to change this name? So now what we need is we'll have a community process where people can suggest other names. That part of the process remains the same. But instead of waiting for somebody to come forward and say, hey, this is a name I find really, really offensive or a racial slur, the state is actually going to initiate that process.
Actually, Senator, not everyone agrees that all these names are offensive. Even on KOW's Facebook page, when we posted that story about Coon Lake, I'm sure people will argue now. Let's act on the racism, not the name Jim Crow.
Well, the name signifies so much else. All of the history of Jim Crow, for anybody who doesn't know it, is about exclusion, slavery, discrimination. We renamed Martin Luther King Jr. County because we wanted to say this is meaningful for us in the county. Martin Luther King was a great man. He did great things. We want our county to be inclusive.
Pramila Jayapal is a Washington State Senator, and she's asking the state to proactively review dozens of ethnically and racially offensive place names here in Washington State. On the subject of who we honor and how, I interviewed an African-American student who complained about the presence of this big statue of a slaveholder named George Washington at the entrance to the UW campus. I asked Jesse Jackson about that. I said, should that statue come down? And he said, no, put more information on the base of that statue about who George Washington was and what he did. What about the argument of keep the name, keep the history, explain the history of how this happens, who we were?
I do think the issue of educating people about the history of the country is really, really important. I would rather not have it as a place that you go to have a walk or go take a swim or go hunting or go fishing. Nobody's going to stop and read a big placard that says, we're naming this Jim Crow so that you can understand how bad Jim Crow was for this country. That's not really how that happens. If you have a name change process, we as leaders can come in from the community. I'm not talking about me going down there. I'm talking about people from that community saying, hey, you know what? We've always enjoyed Jim Crow Creek or whatever it is. That was a favorite place of ours. But we didn't realize how much that name is tied to the legacy of slavery and racism in this country. And we actually want to come together now as a community to use this as a moment to educate our own community, to find a name that we actually can be proud of. We are better than this. We can have names that reflect today's time, not the time of centuries ago or even 50 years ago.
It seems especially troubling that someone maybe who lives in a city feels excluded from one of our great natural areas in our state,
yeah.
as if the wider world and a place of peace is not for them.
Yeah, I think our parks are unfortunately, particularly our national parks, are unfortunately not frequented as much by people of color. And so there's a lot of ways in which we institutionalize racism, and then we look at the effects of it and we say, oh, it's so strange, you know, people of color don't use the parks. Maybe they just don't like green space. Well, I'm sorry, but, you know, of course there are people of color, white people, brown people, black people who don't like green space. But the reality is most of us either never had access to it or felt excluded from it because of our conditions, because of the challenges of getting to some of those spaces, because we did live in very urban areas.
You know, it's not 1960. Why do you think it took this long for these names to come up as a problem? Jim Crow, Coon, Red Man, Squaw?
Well, unfortunately, I'm sure you will get lots of comments from people who think that these aren't important. And then there's a group of people who I think feel like somehow they are being called racist. If there's a name that is going to be changed and we're saying the name is racist, if you are somebody who has not known about it in the past or maybe even not thought it was so bad, that by implementing this process, that you will be admitting to being a racist. And to those people, I would just say, listen, everybody's got racist blood in them somewhere along the line. We've all done things that, you know, our ancestors have all done things that have somehow oppressed somebody or the other. This isn't about any individual being racist or not being racist. It's about recognizing that we are in a different time and we have an opportunity to take away some of what was clearly racism 50 years ago, 100 years ago. Hopefully people will understand that, you know, you get to stand up for something that's good, which is a great name that a community can come together and do together.
Washington State Senator Pramila Jayapal. Washington is now in the process of proactively reviewing dozens of geographic names in our state, names she calls ethnically and racially offensive. It's KUOW's The Record. This is KUOW's The Record. 550 kindergartners under one roof. That's Mukilteo School District's plan for a huge kindergarten-only school. KUOW's education reporter Ann Dornfeld explains.
A few years ago, Mukilteo had a conundrum. The district planned to turn all of its half-day kindergarten classes into full day. That meant it needed twice as many kindergarten classrooms. But a lot of the district's elementary schools were already packed. So the district came up with a plan, a school dedicated entirely to kindergarten.
Imagine this, getting down on your hands and knees, you know, and being back to that five-year-old level and looking at the world. It's such a different perspective.
Longtime kindergarten teacher Heather Craigs helped the district design the new school. She says what started as a solution to overcrowding is now being seen as an exciting way to help usher young children into their school careers. Most of them will be from low-income families, including many learning English, kids who can have a tough time getting up to speed in kindergarten.
And so we wanted a place that was colorful. We wanted a place that was inviting and was really geared to one age of student.
Kindergartners spend a lot of time on the carpet, so the floors will be heated. There will be extra playground equipment, so many classes can go to recess at once. And instead of students having to line up and walk to other classrooms for music and PE, those teachers will give lessons in students' homerooms to save transition time. Mukilteo voters approved a bond that includes $34 million for the building. Kindergarten-only schools are unusual. There's only one other in Washington State. What's more common is the other end of the spectrum, combination kindergarten and first grade classrooms.
And when your group is ready, you can tell, instead of telling me, tell your partners.
I know how to write about Star Wars.
Oh, come on.
Episode 5.
Danielle Guzman teaches kindergarten and first grade at Leschi Elementary in Seattle.
In K-1, the kindergartners probably have an easier time transitioning into kindergarten because they have this core group of mentors and leaders that already know where the pencils go. They know how to get to the bathroom. They know how to tie shoes and to where to put their lunches and all these logistical things that are really a staple of what kindergarten is.
Guzman says teaching both ages allows her to put kindergartners who are just learning to read with first graders who are still at that level.
Likewise, I'm able to group those kindergartners who might be reading fluently and really getting into some deeper content areas with first graders who are working on that.
So which approach makes the most sense for kindergarten? I asked Barbara Willer, a senior advisor at the National Association for the Education of Young Children. Willer says K-1 classes have a proven track record of serving both ages well, if done correctly. She says a kindergarten-only school has the advantage of focusing entirely on one age level and meeting those specific needs, but it would require another transition just 1 year into a child's school career.
If they were to stay at one school for a number of years, really helps them mature within the same school and same community. Whereas if it's a kindergarten-only school, they would only have 1 year of that experience.
Transportation is another issue. Because the kindergarten-only school will draw from half of Mukilteo, most kids will need to bus or be driven to school. But Willer says any model of kindergarten can work well if it's carefully delivered.
Frankly, I think that the more important aspect is making sure that the teachers and administrators really are focusing on meeting the individual needs of children and providing a high-quality learning experience, regardless of the setting.
Groundbreaking for Mukilteo's kindergarten-only school begins in April. It's slated to open next year. I'm Ann Dornfeld, KUOW News.
Bringing you KUOW's The Record, I'm Bill Radke. Welcome. This fall, you're going to vote on a $50 billion plan to expand light rail north to Everett, south to Tacoma, and across Lake Washington to the east side. After those lines are built, we'll see more light rail from Ballard to downtown. Is that the right order? Sound Transit board member Claudia Balducci represents Bellevue and Kirkland and much of the east side of the King County Council. She's also the former mayor of Bellevue.
Like many places, Bellevue's got a big and growing urban center, and many of our cities do outside of Seattle, and growing populations. We have great employers that people go to and from every day, like Google, like a little company on the east side called Microsoft, as we just heard this week, REI moving to the east side. We also know that when we look at just the bridges, the commute east-west is the same in both directions. It's not mostly people going to Seattle in the morning and coming home at night. It's people going wherever they have to go, and a lot of people are going east and west. A lot of people are going north and south. These lines are critical to connect all those places.
Some critics of this draft plan have said Seattle should be served better first because it's got the most riders. For example, the line from downtown to Ballard, where ridership's expected to be huge, that's not going to happen until 2038 after these other extensions. What's your response to the criticism?
So speaking specifically to the Ballard line, one of the issues that we have just strictly of building the line is that to add this amount of new train capacity in Seattle requires a second tunnel under downtown. It's a huge project. It takes a long time to plan and build. I will not invoke the other tunneling project lest it cause some kind of bad mojo, but it takes longer, and that's part of the big part of the reason why you see Ballard being so far out. Financing is also a big part of the reason why you see the projects having to lay out in order the way they do.
Everett is going to wait 25 years for a light rail line. Congressman Rick Larson said, there may be a lot of head scratching. I'm not scratching my head. I'm banging it against the wall, end of quote. What do you think about that long timeline?
Well, I feel a little bad for the congressman. I hope he's not harming himself. You know, when you think back to where we started this, we started with a vote in this region in 1968. If that vote had gone yes, or if the one in 1970 had gone yes, we would be seeing those lines coming online right about now. We'd be done. We'd be finishing up. But we're starting today. You can only do so much. It's a $50 billion package with some revenue streams that are going to be a real lift. How big would those have to be in order to bring forward the kind of timelines that people want to see? I think heavier than you could do. That said, I mean, I have a 10-year-old, and everybody does the count. I do the count, you know, what year in college will he be in, what year in grad school. But if I don't start building it now, he'll never get to ride it. So that's why I think it's important to pass this measure, even with the timelines.
Let's talk about that price tag. As you said, $50 billion. What do you say to assuage somebody with sticker shock right now? We're committing ourselves for a long time to a lot of money.
I think that the ongoing success and livability in this region is dependent on us building this system. Anybody who's been anywhere else, I grew up as a child in New York City, and anybody who's been anywhere else knows that a really, really successful city, a really successful region has got tremendous traffic. They all do. But to keep it livable and to keep it attracting the kind of jobs and employers that we want to see, you need to have a mass transit system. We don't really have one. And this is our chance to build it. It would have been a lot cheaper, again, in the 60s or the 70s when the federal government was funding 90% of the lines at that time. Famously, our federal money went to Atlanta. So it doesn't get cheaper. And if we don't build it now, we'll be faced with building it at some point in the future when it's even more expensive or not at all. And I think that that would be extremely damaging to our long-term success as a region.
We're talking with King County Council member Claudia Balducci, member of the Sound Transit Board, about extending light rail. I used to live in Los Angeles, and I sort of knew there was a little subway there, but it's just not really in the consciousness. What makes you think a modern, young, Western city is ever really going to embrace subway and rail like they do in the East?
I have to say, I would have had a much harder time answering that question a couple of weeks ago before we opened the U-Link line, but I see the way people are embracing it here, the way people have changed their rides around. I'm reading and hearing stories of folks who have just kind of changed the way they travel around in just a few days because they have this
option. But those are people in the city of Seattle. Sure. What about suburban? And I know Bellevue is a city, but you know, what about right. the suburban residents? Will they, you know, there's just such an entrenched culture here. Our cities were built in an age yep. of the car.
All of those folks, me included, when we drive in during rush hour from Bellevue or wherever to our jobs, wherever, we're sitting in traffic, sometimes crippling traffic. 405 is an incredible logjam every day. People are spending hours a week in traffic. I think if you give folks an opportunity to get out of that traffic, they will take it. But I also recognize that there are people who have jobs or trips that aren't well served by transit and possibly never will be well served by transit. So we want the whole system to work together. For those who can ride, that's one less car on the streets. For those who can't, that's a little more room for them to move around if they have to drive.
What's your pitch to a persuadable no vote who's listening to you?
Well, I would hope that that person really cares about the community and the region the way I do, and that they want it to be successful. They want the next generation of people to have great jobs. They want us to continue to be the dynamic, exciting place that we are. And they want to preserve the environment. They want to reduce greenhouse gases. They want to have options to get around that don't involve sitting in traffic for hours every day. And I would say to them, you know, part of our responsibility as members, as citizens and members of a community, is to do what it takes for the future. And I would urge them to join me in doing that here by supporting us building out finally the mass transit network that we've needed here for decades.
Sound Transit Board member and King County Council member Claudia Balducci. For another perspective on the massive light rail plan coming to your ballot this fall, we call Jonathan Hopkins, political director of the nonprofit group Seattle Subway, which advocates for expanding mass transit options in Seattle. Hopkins told me that everyone in the region deserves good transit, but he thinks we need to build a line from Ballard to downtown first.
This line is going to haul the population of Bellevue every single day of the week. 114,000 to 145,000 people is the estimated ridership. That's higher than any line west of Chicago, north of San Francisco. This one line will haul as many riders as the entire Portland MAX system, the light rail system down there, on just this 7.5 mile line. So the things that we shouldn't do is wait to get that many cars off the road. We should do it as soon as we can.
Jonathan, you're not just asking for a line to Ballard faster. You've got a problem with how the line is being laid out. What's the issue?
Well, right now, there's going to be a tunnel through downtown, and that tunnel goes to the Lower Queen Anne area. But once you get north of the Mercer 15th Avenue intersection, the train is in and along the roadway. And that means that we would be building this really high usage line the same way we built the Rainier Valley. My experience with the Rainier Valley is getting notices every week or two that the tracks are shut down and trains are delayed because the train hit a truck or somebody walked in front of the train or there's some other blockage on the tracks. We can't do that. The train should not have intersections with cars. And if we can remove that, then we end up with the type of high quality line that this region desires, deserves, and requires to function.
Well, so far, Seattle's gotten all the light rail service. Couldn't you argue that suburban communities ought to be served next before another line for Seattle?
So I think that all communities need to get benefits from the transportation system. Seattle, when this whole ST3 package is finished, Seattle, the largest city in the region, will have about 30% of the stations and about 30% of the light rail tracks. So the suburbs are getting light rail service because they're paying for it too, and they deserve to service, and the suburbs are getting their lines faster in many cases. The first two lines finished are Federal Way and Redmond, and then the next batch of lines under the current plan are Tacoma and going north of Linwood that comes in the same time as West Seattle. So we do think it's equitable in the sense of, you know, different areas are getting what they pay for, and they're getting it as fast as Sound Transit believes they can produce it. But this line has just astonishing ridership, and it needs to be treated like it does.
Let's say the plan does change and a light rail to Ballard gets more priority. How does life change in Seattle?
Bill, have you had a chance to ride on light rail from Capitol Hill to UW?
Not yet.
Okay. It's pretty life-changing. It's not just Seattle. It's for the whole region that places that we thought were far apart or that took too long in slogging traffic suddenly become close. Our neighborhoods become close. Our neighbors become close. I was at Capitol Hill Station and somebody came up to me and said, you guys, because I'm with Seattle Subway, you guys need to talk about how this same saves friendships. And they talked about their friend in Ballard who does not have their own transportation means. And so they sometimes go on transit or sometimes drive to pick her up. And it's a 45-minute slog. On these systems, it would be 8 to 12 minutes or 17 minutes, depending on where they're going from. And the sense of awe that people have when they go into a high-quality rail system, and we saw it in Capitol Hill and UW, people are looking up almost like children in awe and wonderment of like, okay, we're doing big city things now. Our neighborhoods are close. We can do more in our communities, whether we live in Issaquah and want to do something in Ballard or whether we're just trying to get from Ballard to Beacon Hill. The bottom line is life matters, and the life with your families and doing your passions and making a living are all important to people. They shouldn't have to spend more time doing it because they're just stuck in traffic.
If this plan does not change, goes on the ballot as is, yes vote or no vote?
I think it's important that we move forward, but I do expect that there's going to be a lot of folks saying this really needs to happen faster. And, you know, being basically three times the size of any other line ridership in the entire package, it should happen as soon as it can.
Jonathan Hopkins there, not coming out yet, yes or no, political director for the nonprofit group Seattle Subway, advocating for more mass transit options in Seattle. And you also heard from King County Council member Claudio Balducci, who's also a member of the Sound Transit Board. We are tweeting out a link right now to the Sound Transit 3 draft plan. It's an interactive map. Maybe it'll help you make your decision. The Sound Transit Board adopts a final plan this June, and then you're going to vote on it in November. It's KUOW's The Record. Welcome to The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. The University of Washington women's basketball team is making history. They are on their way to the NCAA Final Four for the first time. Talia Walton is a senior on the team, and she says going to the Final Four is surreal.
You know, I'll be sitting at home and just have a little moment where I just kind of like grab my mom's hand. I was like, Mom, like, going to the Final Four, and so then we'll have a moment. But like Coach is saying, it's probably not going to kick in until we get out there and do all the festivities and see our hotel decked out in purple and gold and whatnot. But I'm so excited.
Talia Walton, senior forward out of Federal Way. If the Huskies beat Syracuse Sunday, they're going to play in what's essentially the Super Bowl of college basketball. Elise Woodward is a Huskies radio broadcaster. Welcome, Elise.
How's it going?
It's good. What about you? You've been traveling with this team the whole tournament. What are the players saying? How are they reacting about making it this far?
Well, you guys, I think as somebody, I played at Washington in the late 90s, and as somebody who has seen just about as much Husky basketball as anybody out there, I don't think the players right now really understand what they just accomplished. I mean, they know it's the Final Four and how big of a deal it is. But I think it's going to take them years for it to really sink in that they made history and got to the Final Four as a 7 seed. That's the lowest seed that's gotten to the Final Four since 2004 when Minnesota did it. So the run that they made and being an underdog like that was just a special, it's been a special ride, and I don't think they're done yet.
What are they going to understand when that hits them?
You know, maybe next year at the Final Four when they're watching it, when if they're a senior like Talia Walton, or, you know, I'm not sure when it's going to sink in. Maybe for some of them it already has, but the scope of this accomplishment, it's first time in program history. There's only been a select number of programs in the Pac-12 period that have made the Final Four, Cal and Stanford, and now UW joins them. So it is rare. It is a rare accomplishment, and you know, they just have come together at the exact right time, and they're really peaking.
Is there a player you're especially excited to watch this weekend?
Well, they have so many players to root for, and fifth-year senior Talia Walton's a Federal Way kid. She had to she nearly couldn't play all 5 years. The doctors told her knees were so bad when she was a freshman that she had to redshirt, which meant she didn't play a single game, rehabbed her knees, tried to get healthy, lost some weight, and now she is 4 years later leading this charge for Washington, somebody you can really root for. Chantel Ozahor, big number zero, big lefty that doesn't even lift the ground at all when she shoots. Everybody loves her, and she's just a monster rebounder. And then Kelsey Plum is the best player in Washington basketball history. She's phenomenal, and she was the third leading scorer in the nation. She's already the Husky leading scorer all time, and she's only a junior. She's just a really special talent, and they're all really humble, understated women. It's really fun to watch them.
It's the first time UW's made it to the Final Four. What does this mean for the program in the future?
Well, I think the recruiting class for this year has already been set, but moving forward to the future, they broke through the ceiling. And every program says, hey, we want to be a Final Four type of program. Well, now Washington is. And so when they go out, the exposure that they're getting, it's just like a week-long commercial in the Final Four of what Husky basketball is all about. And they have a really good coach that the players really respect him. They play hard for him, and he's really smart. And he's a player's coach. He listens to their input. He had one of the players, Chantel Ozahor, in the last game say, hey, coach, should we switch up and play man-to-man defense right now? And he said, I think that's a great idea. 5 minutes left in the game, and he's taking input from a player because he's that confident.
Wow.
In his players and in his own self, that he doesn't have to be a power-tripping coach like you've seen. So, you know, the Husky program is one that I think a lot of people will be exposed to this week for the Final Four and really come to know what a great program that it is.
Odds of winning the championship, and you got to think the Goliath of Connecticut there, but what are the odds?
Well, they first have to get by Syracuse,
yeah.
And Syracuse and Washington actually played earlier this year, and Syracuse won by 4. The day after Thanksgiving, it was the same day as the Apple Cup, so that was a long time ago. And I think Washington's a much better team. So they first have to beat Syracuse, which they're probably slight underdogs to Syracuse, who's the 4 seed, and they're the 7 seed. But I think they can absolutely, it's a 50-50 type of game against Syracuse. And then if you play the University of Connecticut, everybody says, oh, what can you do, what can you do? Well, it would be an epic victory if they can get it. I mean, we're talking an all-time upset underdog, miracle on ice, you know, United States back in the day. That would be the type of victory. I would say most people would give them like a 10% or less chance of beating UConn in the final, but you only need one chance. And who knows, foul trouble, injuries, anything can happen. There'll be a ton of pressure on University of Connecticut if they can get there.
Elise Woodward, radio broadcaster for the Huskies women's basketball team. Thank you so much. Good luck.
Hey, no problem.
Huskies play Syracuse in the Final Four this Sunday. Do you believe in West Coast miracles? We'll see. You're with KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Internet fame is fleeting, so we understand if you've already moved on from Man in Tree. To remind you, last week a young bearded man climbed 80 feet up in a sequoia in downtown Seattle and stayed there for 25 hours. Somebody created hashtag Man in Tree, and then it was everywhere. The subject of memes, status updates, tweets. Well, we now know that Man in Tree has a name. He's Cody Lee Miller. And Cody has a mom, Lisa Gossett. She lives in Wasilla, Alaska. And incredibly, she missed the whole thing. Didn't find out about it until her friend called from Oregon the next day and told her about it, and told her it was Cody. I asked her what she thought when she heard.
Well, my daughter and I were watching it and shed a lot of tears because, you know, this is not the kid that we knew. The beard, the long hair, the way he looks, it's not even him. And I'm sad. I don't want his life to count for nothing. And I want to get him help. And it's just devastating.
Well, Lisa, for all of us who know your son Cody as Man in a Tree, who is the Cody you know?
He was a rambunctious little kid. He was diagnosed with ADHD, so he had a little bit of behavioral problems, not many. Had a lot of energy, always outside playing and actually climbing to the top of trees, you know, just picking up every spider and lizard and just a kid that just loved nature and was, you know, pretty happy.
What happened to Cody?
I really don't know. That's the thing. A few years back, you know, probably 5 or 6 years, started noticing just a little bit of different behavior, things he would tell me, and I'm just looking at him like in disbelief. And, you know, and some of the things he would do, I was just thinking to myself, geez, what is going on here? But we'd go downtown, and he wouldn't want to go in the store. And if I did talk him into it, he would put his hood way down over his face. And then the whole time he's like telling me that people are looking at him, that everybody's looking at him. And I tell him, nobody's looking at you. He said, no, everybody is looking at me. So it was hard to get him out in public. Then one incident, he was down in the basement sleeping. Then he screams up in the middle of the night, calls my name. And I said, what? And he said, there's an evil presence down here. And I said, no, there's not. And he goes, yes, there is, Mom. It's terrible. It's evil. And it scares me. I said, Cody, there's nothing to be scared of. You know, I talked to him for a while and, you know, he finally calmed down. But little things like that, I started noticing. But I had no idea that he'd be getting sick. But I was wondering what was going on there.
We're talking with Lisa Gossett. She is the mother of Cody Lee Miller. And you may know Cody better as Man in the Tree after this incident where he climbed up to the top of the big sequoia in downtown Seattle. Lisa, there was so much reaction, as you know, national, international reaction. Some people laughing, some people making your son out to be like a hero, writing songs and putting him on T-shirts. I wonder how all of that sat with you.
You know, I've read a lot. I've looked at probably every site there is, you know, and there's people that are really mean, but he also has a lot of supporters, like leave him alone kind of deal. And, you know, people making T-shirts and more likely making money off of it. You know, some people thought it was a joke and some people literally took it seriously, like, hey, this guy might need help. I mean, people don't just climb 80-foot trees set in the top for 24 hours, you know, if you're normal, if you're not sick. And it's upsetting when I see people talk like that. I think many people have become callous because there's so much of it that they don't realize that person is a human being. And, you know, hey, there is a problem. What got him here? We need to open our eyes and see that there are many sick people with no help.
You know, Lisa, what some people were upset about was the tree, the damage that Cody did to the Macy's Christmas tree. What do you think of that?
My thought is, you know, it's a tree. I mean, I know it's been there for years and stuff, but what about the human life up there? I'm sorry about that tree, but this is my thought. You know, every time someone walks downtown Seattle and they see that tree missing the branches, maybe they'll look up there and remember Cody and remember this day, and maybe they'll see changes, you know, because this could be your son, somebody else's son, someone's mother, someone's father. What's the world coming to when we're worried about a tree more than a kid in the top of it? It will be a monument for a long time of my son. My sick son was up in that tree, and he doesn't even know what a national, international story he's made. But maybe because of him, there can be some changes made, and because maybe I can try to help the best I can.
For people who don't have somebody in this situation, somebody who needs help and just can't or won't help themselves, how can you explain to them what it's like to be the person trying?
It's frustrating because, you know, when he's been in jail, you know, he's been in jail a lot and they let him back out and back in. And that's the only time that I can write him letters and send money. And it's totally frustrating because if you're 18 with a mental illness, your family can't get involved. You can't get a hold of any records. They can't give out information. Every avenue you turn, there's a roadblock.
What would you say to police and to your son's jailers, if you could?
Well, I have. You know, when he has been in jail, I've called the mental health nurses. And I got lucky one night, you know, so many years back, and had him picked up in Salem. And they kept him overnight and let him go the next day. It's obvious that he's sick. The things he says, the things he does, everybody's out to get him. And I would say, when they're in jail and they're sick, we need to have a plan. Let's get them on meds. Let's get them, you know, feeling like, hey, I feel pretty normal today. There's got to be a plan to help these people rather than throwing them back out on the streets. You know, he gets in trouble because he doesn't check in with his parole officer. He doesn't even know the time of day. How's he supposed to check in once a month? So he goes back to jail, back out again, thrown out on the streets. It's just a Band-Aid. Let's fix this problem.
We're talking with you from Wasilla, Alaska. Lisa, why aren't you with your son?
Well, I have talked to him before this went completely haywire. I have to get things in order to go back down there, but I can never get him in one spot. And him being in the state of mind that he is, will he let me come down and talk to him? I've tried, and then he's out. You know, by the time I could get down there, he's gone. Also, you know, does he even know he has a family? I've tried. It's the fact of trying to keep up with them and trying to get him in the state of mind where I can even talk to him, you know, have him get committed so I can go down there and try to be there for him and try to talk to him. But it's also very scary, too. You know, it's a catch-22, but I want to be there for my son.
Lisa, this cannot be an enjoyable story to tell. I know you've gotten a whole lot of phone calls. Why are you doing this radio interview?
I'm doing this interview and many others because I want to get awareness out there. I want the laws to change. I want it to be where if you have a sick family member, because your family knows you, if there are odd things going on and you see that there's a problem, family members should be able to get together and have their loved ones committed, be able to get into their files, maybe power of attorney or whatever, and work with these people on getting them help. But everywhere you turn, they're 18. You can't know anything. I mean, I'm in the dark a lot of the times. But when you see someone sick, your family member, you guys should be able to get together, get them committed, and get them help. But there is no way possible to do this. I want the laws to change on that.
Lisa Gossett. Her son, Cody Lee Miller, was known across the internet and across Seattle as Man in Tree for 25 hours last week. Today he's in police custody, scheduled to be arraigned in a couple of weeks or so. Last year, Washington's governor, Jay Inslee, signed Joel's Law that allows Washington families to petition a court to involuntarily commit a mentally ill loved one. This is KUOW's The Record. KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. Did you go to the Bernie Sanders rally at Safeco Field a few days ago? Oh, well then you've heard Taco Cat. They're a feminist punk band popular in the Capitol Hill music scene. Seattle DJ Marco Collins says Taco Cat is like the Go-Go's meets Bikini Kill.
I brought three different tracks to kind of play you guys. The first one's called I Hate the Weekend, and most people would think, what?
Why we live for the weekend.
Wait, we live for the weekend. However, this band is situated on Capitol Hill, and if you're familiar with what's been going on Capitol Hill, the Weeknd's completely changed the face of the hill.
People going to clubs and bars and harassing people.
Yeah, and harassing people. A whole different group of people end up on the hill who never used to go there. It's kind of a bridge and tunnel crowd, if you will.
Right.
If you're from the East Coast,
you know what that means. Bridge and tunnel. Yeah. Suburban crowd.
It's a completely different crowd, and it kind of messes up things for the Weeknd.
What do you like about this song?
I love the energy again to me is what I love about them. They crack me up. Like, their message is serious. Emily, who writes the songs for the band, she's got some things to say. These lyrics are not meaningless lyrics. They're not love songs. They're songs that are about issues she's concerned about. However, the tone of the music is very upbeat and happy and sort of carefree. I love that juxtaposition.
The Northwest has got a history with feminism and rock music. Slater Kinney was, you know, jumps to mind.
Right.
Famous, you know, what, a generation ago now?
Yeah.
So compare then to now.
Again, I think, you know, with Taco Cat, I think that it is definitely a feminist band. You know, their message is strong, and they definitely have their opinions, and I feel like it's the sound that's different. You know, it's the sound that's more jovial. It's nice to see women in, you know, playing and fronting bands and out there kind of dominating. And, you know, when I listened to this record, I thought, this record is so much better produced than their last record, that this is really going to light some people up. People are going to love this thing.
And Taco Cat plays the new version of a theme song for Powerpuff Girls on Cartoon Network.
I don't know how they got this, but pretty amazing that they were able to, you know, record that theme.
The song is Who's Got the Power? A punk band doing a corporate theme song, even for the Cartoon Network. I'm old enough to remember when somebody would have called that selling out.
I don't know that selling out exists anymore. You know, back in the day, selling out, yeah, you're right. I don't know that this, if, in this day and age, you know, the music industry is a mess. For them to be asked to record a theme song like this, I don't know how much money they got, but it's for the Cartoon Network. If you're going to do it for something that you love. And I, you know, clearly these women love Powerpuff Girls. Plus, to have that kind of an influence on a younger generation is pretty cool.
Plus, they're purposely kind of cartoonish in their videos. Their
Absolutely.
Whole approach is fun.
Yeah, they're very, you know, the whole live show is very caricature-oriented as well.
So it doesn't clank.
Right.
Let's go out on one more song.
So the last song that I brought is a song called Talk. It was their first official single, and this song is all about walking around, staring at your cell phone, and I got to say, I'm very guilty of this. Together alone, stay true to your phone.
Together alone, stay true to your phone. How big is Taco Cat right now?
Not very big. Not, I mean, you know what? I have a feeling that this is going to take off. It just feels like it's ready, and the scene is ready for it.
Legendary Seattle DJ Marco Collins has been listening to feminist punk band Taco Cat, and he thinks you should too. Taco Cat's new album, Lost Time, comes out tomorrow. There'll be a record release concert tonight at Chop Suey. Jason Pagano is the producer of this show, engineer Bernard Ouellette. Each of them subscribes to the podcast. I don't know whether it's their podcast app or our website. Either way, they never miss an interview, so be like them. They follow us on Twitter at KUOW and on Facebook, we're KUOW Public Radio.